The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we've watched gold and silver just continue to climb, really without correction. We've been getting calls, people saying, hey, when do you expect the correction? But every once in a while, we do get little corrections, and they're expected timing events, but they're not necessarily something you'd read about in the newspaper.
Well, I think if you look back at the last 10 years and look at a chart of either gold or silver, it looks like there's been uninterrupted growth. In fact, that's not the case. We've had two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward, one step back, a steady progression, which has taken us to some pretty significant levels.
Well, and that's a normal bull market, isn't it? I mean, you go up a little bit, and then, of course, the traders take a profit or what have you.
Yeah, and usually what precipitates those declines or something in particular, this is a classic case in point. The 26th of April is options expiration. And so you have many leveraged positions, which either have to be closed out or will be worthless. They will expire worthless. A bet that the price of metals would be price X by time X.
Either up or down. You can bet both directions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But getting to options expiration, there's typically volatility when you have this date occur. Par for the course. No big deal. I would relish a correction in both metals. If we could see a 6, 7, 8% correction in gold, a good 15, 20% correction in silver, these would be healthy corrections. This is what allows for these markets to be extended over a longer period of time. And Kevin, that's sort of micro in the markets. We've got the Dow and the S&P moving higher with the expectation that quantitative easing will continue. This is a dope that the market really is enjoying. And it's interesting. If you take it away, if it's not renewed in June, you're likely to see some downside volatility. On that volatility issue, Kevin, we've got the VIX, the volatility index, which is peaked below 15 earlier in the week.
Why don't you explain that a little bit to the listeners? What does the VIX actually tell us?
The volatility index is basically an expectation monitor, if you will. Are we going to see prices go up or down? And the lower the VIX gets, the lower that index gets, people are really comfortable and are assuming that there's no downside.
So they're just on cruise control when the VIX is low.
Exactly. Yeah. And you see a spike in the VIX when people are concerned about price volatility, when they're concerned about the prices going down, particularly in equities. So we've got relatively high complacency in the stock market. Every time, Kevin, in the last year where the VIX has slipped below 15, it has, within a matter of days or weeks, spiked to 25 to 40. And what that means is we do have a correction in equities around the corner, if you're using that as a forward indicator.
Well, you know, David, what it reminds me of is a guy who's sort of falling asleep at the wheel. You know, you get a little too comfortable, the heat's on in the car,
and you start to doze. Bumps on the side of the road.
And then all of a sudden, yep.
And it wakes you up. Whoa, wait a minute.
So the VIX is a good indicator that way. Well, okay, this brings us then to the subject of today's conversation, though, David, because, you know, when we talk about corrections, we're talking about a correction versus a particular currency. In this case, we're talking about the U.S. dollar. Now, the dollar has enjoyed for decades what our guest today talks about as exorbitant privilege, okay? And that's the reserve currency status. But over the last week or two especially, we've started to see things that are chipping away at that reserve currency status or the potential of it. Even the IMF is now talking about China overtaking, you know, the United States at a much more rapid pace than what they had originally said.
And on the same front, Kevin, the IMF said just 2 weeks ago that the U.S. lacks a credible strategy to stabilize its mounting public debt. They said it poses a small but significant risk of a new global economic crisis. And, you know, they're looking at the balance sheet the way our foreign creditors are looking at the balance sheet,
right,
scratching their head saying, I don't know if this is going to end well. And interestingly, Mr. Eichengreen in today's interview actually picks a date and says, no, in fact, it might not go well, particularly if you're looking out on the time horizon and 2013 is of any interest to you.
Well, and, you know, let's go ahead and put Mr. Eichengreen in perspective for our listener. This is a man who writes for Foreign Affairs. He's written a number of academic books published by Oxford University Press. You know, he would fall into the category of a Keynesian economist. Now, we've talked to Keynesians throughout the years. We've talked to Austrians. We've talked to monetarists. There's different mindsets. But, David, we truly are under a Keynesian regime, like it or not, right now. And so we actually have to consult the guys who have those central bankers' ears.
Kevin, I think that's one of the most important things we can do on a regular basis is understand the context that we are in.
Right.
And so to look at our political elite and wonder who is the whisper, who is the informed opinion that they're relying on so heavily, that is where a Barry Eichengreen fits into the picture, because he's been professor of politics and economics at UC Berkeley for a good many decades, Kevin, and he is an established academic. He is well regarded for many of his books, Golden Fetters, European Economy Since 1945, Global Imbalances and the Lessons of Bretton Woods. When it comes to monetary history and the interplay between politics and economics, this is a guy who is central. And from any administration's perspective, primarily because whether it's Republicans or Democrats, guess what they are primarily when it comes to their economic views? They're Keynesians. So
right.
Who would they go to for an opinion? The best and the brightest, quote unquote, within that sphere, and that's the role that he plays. He is a seer, if you will, within a particular community. And it's vital, not only for our listeners, but our clients as well, to understand that the decision makers today have their influences. And if you want to see where we're going, an orchestrated, not an accidental, but an orchestrated decline in the dollar, there's reasons for it, there's influences behind those opinions, and there's things that are being put in place today which have a strong intellectual basis. That's the importance of talking to a Barry Eichengreen and maybe even reaching out and getting the book Exorbitant Privilege and seeing it as a script, not necessarily as an analysis.
There you go. Well, you know, David, something that you've encouraged the guys here at the office for years. We read, you know, what is it, a book a month, but they're not always books written by people that we agree with. And David, what's interesting is if you read from all sides, you're going to make a much more objective decision on your investments than having a real strong political view one way or another. That can really hurt your pocketbook.
Kevin, I've got to say, this is an author who I've learned a tremendous amount about, and my appreciation for his work is that as an academic, he has gone through so many details that for you and I as non-academics, we would simply be bored out of our minds. But he's distilled them down and saved us years or decades worth of research and work and put them into a format that we can spend a day, spend a weekend, spend a week going through.
And get a monetary education, basically a monetary history education.
That's exactly right.
Okay, David, well, let's just go ahead and talk to the author of Exorbitant Privilege, Barry Eichengreen.
1977 was a very good year for both the United States and Portugal. For us, we had 80% of international foreign currency reserves denominated in U.S. dollars, and for Portugal, that was one of the best years for port in 100 years. Some things have changed since then. Now we're only about 60% of foreign currency reserves. They're still making great port, not quite the 77 vintage, but we want to take a look at some of the things that are coming into the currency market specifically and our current international monetary regime. The dollar has been the supreme player. We've existed in a unipolar world for some time, and there are things that have been changing and may actually be coming to cusp sorts of events where we could see a more rapid change even from this point. This week we've had the U.S. debt put on negative watch by S&P. Goldman has looked at GDP estimates and revised them from 3.25 to 2.5 and then to 1.75. Our economy apparently is not growing as fast as they were anticipating it to. What we see happening internationally is a recognition of balance sheet frailties in the United States. The BRIC countries are seeking to diversify through settling trade in their own currencies, and they're looking for alternatives. Do they have alternatives? Will that include the SDRs suggested by the IMF many decades ago, or will it be new up-and-coming currencies like the euro, the renminbi, or what have you? Today we have Barry Eichengreen joining us to explore both past, present, and future, as we try to wrap arms around what is happening in the international monetary regime and what it means for us today. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
Good to be here.
Let's start with the most newsworthy and present tense. The S&P companies has looked at U.S. debt and has determined that we're not quite as stable as we were once considered to be. Maybe you can explore what they're looking at and what this implies.
Well, it's clear that S&P is worried about, starting in 2013, that the markets will lose patience with the U.S. political class and all the debt that we are issuing, and that the dollar's safe haven status could be jeopardized. So my own view is that S&P are not the canary in the coal mine. They're simply telling us what we already knew. The one thing they did was to put a date on the forecast that everybody is already worried about. Starting in 2013, the markets could grow impatient and fed up with chronic U.S. budget deficits.
We have current budget deficits. We also have the outstanding stock of debt. Roughly two-thirds of that has to be rolled over in the time period between now and 2013. Do you think rollover risk factors into the S&P concerns?
I can't speak for S&P, but I think it should factor into investors' concerns. The Treasury Department is now embarked on a campaign to try to lengthen the maturity structure of the debt to reduce this rollover risk. So I think the very fact that they are engaged in that process is an indication that economists and officials in charge of U.S. economic policy are painfully aware that this risk does exist.
We looked this week at the Chinese central bank governor, Zhu Xiaoshan, who is also concerned about not only dollar holdings, but specifically treasuries, and is suggesting that they create new vehicles through which to diversify away from the U.S. dollar. Now, that certainly has implications for funding of future liabilities. We need to, at least according to the Congressional Budget Office, finance upwards of $1 trillion a year each year for the next 10 years. If we don't have someone there to support the debt markets, where do you see interest rates going in that environment? Do we see a 100 basis point jump, a 200 basis point jump? I mean, is this something where we're moving towards something not only of a dollar crisis, perhaps, but also a debt crisis?
Well, I can imagine two different scenarios. One, in the first one, foreign central banks, including the People's Bank of China, stop adding to their holdings U.S. Treasury debt. The studies that were done of the last decade suggest that interest rates on U.S. Treasury bonds were 50 to 100 basis points lower than they would have been otherwise because of those foreign central bank purchases. So my scenario number one would be one in which interest rates go up by 50 to 100 basis points. Scenario number two is darker. That's one in which foreign central banks grow alarmed about fiscal and financial stability in the U.S., and they not only stop accumulating, but they actively dispose some or all of their holdings, and that would be the dollar crash scenario in which the exchange rate collapses, interest rates shoot up, and so forth. So I'm not predicting scenario number two, but I do think it's something to worry about, and that's why there needs to be a sense of urgency around budgetary negotiations.
On that point, the budgetary negotiations that are taking place in Washington, you know, what was agreed in order to not shut down the government was roughly $38 billion in cuts. Now, as a percentage of the deficit, that's only about 2.4% of the problem solved. How do we make progress on that point?
Well, I think we need to have a debate, number one, about entitlements. So say what you will about Paul Ryan's plan. I personally am not a fan, but it ought to have put the issue of entitlement reform on the table, whether we're going to cut spending on Medicare and Medicaid, for example. It's interesting that there seems to be some public support for the Ryan plan, but at the same time, when you ask Americans, when you poll them, you want to see cuts in Medicare or cuts in entitlements, three-quarters of Americans say no. So we need a debate over that issue. And finally, I think it's going to be, to put a label on it, impossible to solve this problem through spending cuts alone. though politicians consider it poison to talk about tax increases or about allowing the Bush tax cuts to expire or even about revenue enhancement. But I think we're going to have to get there and have a discussion about that if we're ever going to solve the problem.
Certainly there's popular concern with recent news of General Electric moving back to a strong state of profitability and not in recent years paying hardly anything in taxes. I think that will be something that is voted for positively in terms of tax reform and an increase in revenues. Certainly there's openness to that, if nothing else. You know, we have problems in Europe, have had problems in Europe. We explored some of these in a conversation with Otmar Issing many months ago, actually prior to many of these crisis issues coming to a head, and gleaned some insight. We've progressed further into the midst of this crisis. It's a fiscal crisis. It's not solvable along the same classic monetary lines that you would expect, where you can just print more money if you have fiscal problems, because that, in fact, was an issue of sovereignty given over to the ECB, and these individual countries are no longer in control of their monetary destiny. What is the way forward? Is the way forward a greater cooperation at fiscal levels, a greater connection politically? Is that even feasible? I mean, we've seen, whether it's Westphalia or some of the other German states, an absolute revulsion to Germany bailing out these other countries. There's other issues involved, of course, in those elections, but it doesn't seem that there's popular approval, if you will, for a move towards greater political and fiscal connection.
Yeah, well, I think I would disagree a little bit with your characterization, which I think reflects Otmar Issing's characterization that Europe's crisis is a fiscal crisis. Greece's crisis is a fiscal crisis, but elsewhere in Europe, it's basically a banking crisis. So step number one towards solving it will be to strengthen Europe's banks. And I think there has been progress there in the last couple of weeks. Commerzbank, one of the big German banks, has announced that it's going to raise more capital. One of the big Italian banks is following. One of the German state banks, one of the Landesbank, has been instructed to raise more capital. And the European Banking Authority, kind of the EU overseer of the banks, has announced that they will hold the banks pretty high capital standards in second stress tests that are coming in a couple of months. That's good news. Once the banks are strengthened, it'll be possible to restructure the problem debts of countries like Greece and Ireland and Portugal without bringing down the European banking system, without blowing a hole in their balance sheets. And that, I think, will be enough to draw a line under the crisis. So that's the good news. The bad news is that there's going to have to be cooperation among governments, between countries, about how to do this and how to coordinate the bank recapitalization and the debt restructuring. There are those revolts in Germany you described. There was the election of 19% of the vote earned by the True Finn party in Sunday's election in Finland, and they're opposed to financial assistance for the crisis countries. So it's going to be a hard political task to get the cooperation they need.
Well, when we look at the U.S., we've seen a change over time. We once were a creditor nation. You know, looking at our own balance sheet and the issues that we have to sort through if we are going to maintain reserve currency status, or perhaps that's something that is already slipping and cannot be maintained. Would love your opinion on that. But has becoming a net debtor put the U.S. in a precarious position, compromising our international influence?
Well, it certainly doesn't help. It creates a pressure point that, in principle, foreign governments can exploit in a dispute with the United States. So one could imagine a dispute between the U.S. and China over Taiwan in the future, or over policy toward Iran. And China could use its leverage in the U.S. Treasury market to get the U.S. to compromise. That's what we, the United States, did to the UK in 1956 when they were part of the Suez invasion, and we threatened to sell sterling to get them to withdraw. I think the situation now is different because the U.S. is big and the U.S. Treasury market is big, whereas the U.K. and the sterling market were small 50 years ago. If China were to sell treasuries big time in response to a U.S., they would essentially be shooting themselves in the foot as well because they would be taking big losses. But I do agree with the premise of your question that it's not helpful to be in debt to the rest of the world.
When we talk about Great Britain and the Suez Canal, you know, you've noted that a nation whose economy does not grow loses political and strategic power. In what ways are we witnessing that in the U.S. today?
Well, I think to a global power and a global financial and monetary power, in particular, you need three things. You need a big platform. You need a big and growing economy. Number two, you need liquid financial markets. And number three, you need stability that breeds confidence in your currency globally. So the problem you alluded to earlier, that growth forecasts for the U.S. are being revised downward, is a real one. If we balance our budget by cutting spending on infrastructure and education and training for our workers, it's going to be that much harder to grow the economy. I think it's inevitable that the other poorer economies will continue to catch up with the U.S. over time. We were 50% of the world economy after World War II. Now we're closer to 20 or 25%. That is a natural evolution. But if we underperform in terms of growth, we accentuate that problem, and the migration away from the dollar takes place faster than it needs to.
Well, considering the dollar exchange rate, should further depreciation occur, is there a level at which American standards of living would be significantly impacted, in your view?
I think were the dollar to lose its exorbitant privilege as the world's currency, the currency used not only by central banks for reserves, but in international transactions of all kinds, the dollar would be likely to fall by some 20%. And that would translate over time, I suggest in my book, about a 3% decline in U.S. living standards. That's 1 year worth of normal economic growth. It's not a disaster, but Americans would definitely feel it in the pocketbook.
We're not likely to continue consuming and investing $1 trillion more than we produce each year. You were talking earlier about exorbitant privilege. The trade deficit is likely to come in line. Isn't the budget deficit of greater concern? Could you look at those two deficits and say, no, this is actually the greater concern? What's your view? Which has been the greater advantage to us? Being able to finance trillions of dollars of debt in the Treasury market, having that liquid financial market and with stability, being able to finance things into the future, or the exorbitant privilege that you speak of in regards to trade?
I think the budget deficit is, or soon will become, the fundamental problem and external deficit of the United States. The trade and current account deficit is the symptom. So the fact that foreigners have an appetite for dollars means that they lend to us more freely than they would otherwise. And the question is, what do we do with that funding? Do we run yet bigger government budget deficits as a result because we can currently place Treasury debt at low interest rates? Does that remove some of the urgency that should be attached to the budget discussions? I think the answer has been yes. If we take that foreign funding and we invest it recklessly in a real estate bubble rather than investing it in infrastructure, education, training, and other things that enhance the competitiveness of the U.S. economy, then yes, it becomes part of the problem. But fundamentally, in my view, the problem going forward will be the budget deficit, and I still worry that we don't have the kind of frank dialogue around that and discussion across the aisle in the Congress that we're going to need to solve it.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
Obama administration has estimated that the interest component on the national debt will be rising from just under $200 billion a year to about $554 billion over the next 5 years. It's assuming a gradual increase in interest rates. You suggested a couple of scenarios where, in fact, we could see interest rates bump up even more than that, perhaps even putting greater pressure on the interest component. At what level are you concerned about the interest component on our national debt?
Well, we will be in a situation when interest rates return to normal levels in 2013 or thereabouts, where if nothing is done, a quarter to a fifth of all federal government tax revenues will go to debt service, leaving that much less for other purposes. So I'm worried about 2013, like S&P, when the debt-to-national income ratio in the United States will be approaching 100% if nothing is done. If at that point interest rates are back up on Treasury debt, are back up at 4 or 5%, I think that's quite an alarming scenario. And the numbers, it suggests, are larger in terms of the increasing debt servicing burden than the administration forecasts that you mentioned.
How do we keep our foreign creditors from viewing a mild inflation, whether it is a 1.5% to 2% target or some other number, let's say it gets ahead of us and it's 3.5% or 4%, how do we have them satisfied owning U.S. dollar-denominated assets since we really are moving towards a subtle form of default?
Well, it's going to be hard. In other words, private foreign investors have already begun to effectively curtail their purchases of U.S. Treasury debt. It's been mainly the Fed and foreign central banks, almost entirely the Fed and foreign central banks, who have been buying the new debt issuance. So I do think the scenario that you describe is a plausible one. The Fed is not going to be consciously attempting to inflate away the value of the debt, but it will come under pressure not to raise interest rates as quickly as otherwise, because raising them will make the federal budget situation even more difficult to solve, as we were discussing a moment ago. That will translate into more inflation if nothing is done about the deficit problem. So you ask, what can we do about this? I think the answer is put in place a credible medium-term fiscal plan. So even if we can't eliminate the budget deficit in the short term, indeed, I would argue it would be undesirable to eliminate the budget deficit in the short term, because the economy needs that spending support right now with slow growth and unemployment above 8%. But a plan about exactly what we're going to do starting in 2013 would be what those foreign investors need.
You mentioned in your book a meeting between Richard Nixon and the then head of the Federal Reserve, and the pressure was certainly brought on the Fed at that time to devalue or goose the system, if you will, a little bit, create a little bit more liquidity, and in essence create a little bit of inflation. Help me with my concern about Fed independence. How are they, in these periods of financial stress and strain, how are they able to maintain political independence?
Well, the basic answer is that they are not able to maintain it. So central banks are embedded in the political system, like it or not. They have to work as hard as they can. They have to run as fast as they can to limit the challenge to their independence, to limit the erosion of their independence. The Fed has already come under a lot of political pressure because of the unprecedented kinds of interventions in which it had to engage during the financial crisis, and now the difficulty of backing those out. But I think what the Fed needs to do to protect itself is to communicate clearly what its priorities and intentions and strategies are. So I think actually it's a good thing that Mr. Bernanke has gone on 60 Minutes, and that Fed has decided he should hold press conferences several times a year as a way of communicating what they're doing and why, and as a way of trying to remind the public of their mandate and reassert their independence to the politicians. That's effectively all that they can do.
This is a question related somewhat to the Taylor rule. We've kept a zero interest rate policy for some time. We experimented with that in 2002, 2003, and in your book you argue that perhaps the administration at that time kept rates too low, perhaps by as much as 3 percentage points too low. And are we in a similar situation today under a different Fed administration, no longer Greenspan but Bernanke? And does this tie it all into Newt Wicksell's idea that if you keep interest rates too low too long, they ultimately will go much, much higher?
I think there is something to that idea. It's clear that the appetite for risk is back, and part of that is because of the very low interest rates and very low funding costs that investors who want to take a bet in U.S. stock markets or Brazilian stock markets currently face. What I would add to the point, however, is that hindsight is 20/20, that we can look back. I could look back in my book at 2002, 2003 and say the Fed overestimated, with benefit of hindsight, the risk to the economy from 9/11. But we didn't know that at the time. I think, in contrast, the risks to the U.S. economy and financial system in late 2008, early 2009 from Lehman Brothers were very grave, and the Fed was fully justified in terms of lowering interest rates to support the economy and the financial system at that time. Now we are paying a price for that, you know, several prices for it, one of which is the return of excessive risk-taking. But this is simply another way of saying that we dug a very deep hole for ourselves by allowing the financial crisis to take place. And indeed, we are now paying the price for that.
As we move towards a conclusion today, in a recent article, you had April 11th written about tripolar currency system. We've had the unipolar dollar-centric monetary regime since 1944. It's changed somewhat in the post-1971 era where we have a free-floating system. What do you see as the future for a monetary system? Is it something that we as Americans should be concerned about? Certainly Great Britain is still a great country, even though they're not the world's leader, the leader that they were, controlling either the world's landmass that they did or having the kind of influence in the capital markets that they once had. What should our concerns be as Americans when we look at that idea of a tripolar currency system? Is it one of greater stability or one of downgrade for us?
I'm hopeful that it can be a more stable system than the one we've had for the last 20 years. One way of understanding the financial crisis through which we've been through is that there was an imbalance or a tension between what is an increasingly multipolar world, where we are no longer the only big economy. There is also Euroland and China, among others. There's a tension between this multipolar world economy and a still dollar-dominated or dollar-centered monetary and financial system. So the world through which we've lived was one in which, when we hang ourselves, we Americans, by engaging in reckless financial excesses, foreigners give us more rope. They lend to us more freely because they need our dollars for international transactions. I think in a world where there are alternatives to the dollar in the global sphere, where there will also be the euro and the Chinese renminbi, the U.S. will feel market discipline more regularly and earlier if we show signs of engaging in those financial excesses again. Ultimately, that will make the world a safer financial place. So I think 10 years from now, when there will be three global currencies, we can look forward to greater financial stability. The problem is that 10 years is a long time, and history tells us that we tend to get a financial crisis of one sort or another, not every 10 years, but more like every 3 years.
we go back to those three things that you mentioned, having a platform or a growing economy. Certainly China has that. The Euroland in total does, with certain engines of growth primarily. Liquid financial markets, you certainly see that with the euro more than the renminbi. I'm trying to look at those three things that you said that we need, liquid financial markets, stability, and a growing economy, to see which of those apply today or are likely to apply more so in the future for China and the Euroland.
Well, Euroland, first they need to work on the growth. They need to work on the market liquidity because they don't yet have integrated treasury bond market Euroland-wide, and they need to work on the stability in places like Greece and Ireland and Portugal. In the case of China, they have had the growth, although there is debate at the moment about whether and when China will slow down. They need to continue to work on the stability because there are also worries about Chinese financial markets and a housing bubble and so forth. But most of all, they need to work on the market liquidity. I think they're serious about that. They have said by 2020, Shanghai will be a true international financial center, which means we'll have to have liquid markets that are open to the rest of the world. China is moving in that direction. They are, in fact, making faster progress than many people appreciate. So looking at things this way reminds us that greatest strength the dollar has in terms of remaining the leading global currency is that the obvious rivals, the euro and the renminbi, have plenty of problems of their own.
So being the incumbent does have some privileges.
In normal circumstances, so think about an incumbent politician. Normally, incumbency makes it easier to get reelected. But if there is widespread dissatisfaction about the policies of the government, voters turn around and they throw out the bombs. So my worry is that if there developed widespread dissatisfaction and skepticism about U.S. economic policy in the medium term, there could be similarly a light from the dollar, and that would not be a good thing for the U.S.
Perhaps this last question is more on the political than the economic side, but as Harold James pointed out in his book, The End of Globalization, there exists potential conflict, international conflict in the period ahead as individual nations prioritize domestic constituency groups over international cooperation. It's a similar theme that Mr. Kagan picks up in his book, The Return of History and the End of Dreams. I'm interested in what your opinion would be. What risks do we run today of seeing the world move towards greater insularity and away from a cooperative relationship? Would that include the reemergence of capital controls as individual countries kind of clamp down on their version of security and stability? And might the EMU be the reasonable test case to watch and see how this unfolds?
My view, contrary to Harold, is that globalization has come very far and is now very deeply embedded. I do think there will be strains and that we will continue to see more use of capital controls by countries that are having trouble managing financial inflows. There will be trade disputes between the U.S. and China and difficulties in the Congress in ratifying proposed bilateral trade agreements. I'm pessimistic about the successful conclusion of the Doha round of trade negotiations. But all that said, I don't see globalization being rolled back. I think global supply chains are too fully developed. I think Chinese foreign investment has gone too far for the Chinese to turn their backs on globalization. They need our technology and they need foreign energy too desperately to do that. So clearly there will be strains. There always have been. And I think governments have always prioritized the needs of domestic interest groups over international cooperation. It's only when we've had extraordinary leadership, as I think we did briefly at the beginning of 2009, that leaders have been able to come together around the necessary cooperation. So I don't know if all this renders me an optimist or a pessimist. I don't know how much cooperation we're going to have, but I do think that globalization will survive.
if you'll allow one more question, the inflation issue is one that's becoming of greater concern as we talk to people all across the country. There's one thing that I'm recalling from a conversation with Giulio Galrodi. It was that while the gold standard would never be reintroduced and gold is no longer a part of our money system, something that has a discipline should be or needs to be introduced into our money system. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, should we be concerned about inflation? And is there something that needs to change with the dollar and the way the Fed handles our currency to introduce a characteristic, perhaps, of the gold standard without going back to gold specifically?
I think the right way to think about this is in terms of the Fed's mandate. The Fed has a dual mandate to pursue two objectives. The first one is price stability, low and stable inflation. The second one is full employment. So there are people, I'm not one of them, but there are people who say this dual mandate is part of the problem, that we should eliminate the second part, which requires the Fed to worry about the pursuit of full employment and require the Fed to keep its eye on inflation alone. So, you know, if you're one of those folks who's worried about the prospect of runaway inflation in the not too distant future, I think the right way to respond to those fears and the right question to inject into the political debate is whether we should be narrowing the Fed's mandate or not.
Well, that's very helpful, and I appreciate your time today. We look forward to continuing a conversation into the future. Thank you for your most recent contribution, Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar, and the Future of the International Monetary System. This is one of many books we could recommend for authorship, but certainly one that's approachable and gets to some very critical issues that are being discussed today or need to be discussed today. Our listeners would be that much more informed and able to contribute to a dialogue having read your book. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the kind words.
Well, David, Barry Eichengreen, he's got the ear of an awful lot of decision makers worldwide, so he has to be careful what he says. But a couple of things that he focused on over and over was this day of reckoning, possibly in the year 2013. Now, he was careful not to call it a day of reckoning, but if you read between the lines, he's concerned.
Well, Kevin, I think for good reason. I mean, you look at the BRIC countries' decision to seek diversification through settling trade in their own currencies. You look at the Goldman downgrade of GDP growth. You look at U.S. debt being put on negative watch by S&P. Kevin, what he's addressing in the book is very central to what is happening in today's news. Dollar supremacy, what he describes as the unipolar world, moving to a more tripolar world, that's interesting. And the fact that this is wrapped up in a bow, particularly greater global stability,
right,
that has my particular interest, that we're seeing a U.S. downgrade as universally beneficial. So that's worth considering, not necessarily from the standpoint of agreement again, but again, what is happening is a shift in opinion. We used to view having a strong dollar as the greatest way forward and certainly a benefit to U.S. citizens. Now there's a shift in academia. Shift in academia ultimately leads to a shift in policy. Shift in policy ultimately leads to a shift in what we experience as citizenry. And what is that? Well, we should prize a dollar that is worth less over time. Now, I'm not sure how we get there, but we do, in fact, have some things to learn from this book, Kevin.
So what they're telling us is we should prize it, and maybe it would be best for us, even though that's a downgrade in our standard of living.
And I think, Kevin, it's worth going through the different points in this book, whether it is development of U.S. financial markets in the 1920s and 30s, the 1930s Britain, seeing the support that they gave to the banking system, very much like what we're doing right now.
Right.
There's some interesting parallels as you go back to the downgrade that occurred in Europe, you know, circa the 1914 to 1950 period, you know, that World War I, World War II, post-Bretton Woods era, and what we're seeing happen today, Kevin.
Yeah, David, from a historic standpoint, there are a lot of parallels of what we've seen before, not only in Britain, but with France now cashing dollars in for gold back in the 1960s. He talks about that. You've got that same cashing in occurring with China in Asia right now. It's not being done over an official table from the U.S. government, but they've been accumulating a lot of resources. You have also the parallels, like with the Suez Canal that he talked about. He mentioned that in the interview, how we applied political pressure on Britain just by not supporting the pound.
Kevin, I think that the strength of the book was smack dab in the middle, where he's talking about the development of and the history of the EMU and the euro. And there you see a projection forward, what it will take for the EMU to become that much more significant, including British participation in the monetary union. There's a number of things that remain questions in my mind where I think more explanation and I think a deeper exploration is needed, particularly when it comes to the renminbi in China and whatever headwinds they are facing currently, seeing new numbers that real estate there is actually in free fall, the bank raising reserve requirements now to north of 20% and trying to get a hold of inflation, and what are the consequences of that into the marketplace. Kevin, I think for the renminbi to take a regional role or ultimately a global role as a foreign currency alternative, we're going to have to see some interesting things occur there. And in coming months, we'll have a few experts that I already have in mind to address those particular issues relating to China and the growth in Asia that we're seeing and what might impair it.
Well, and that'll be something that we will continue to investigate as the months go on with this program. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Barry Eichengreen, author of Exorbitant Privilege by Oxford University Press. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can call us anytime, business hours, at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.